And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Caleb Johnson to the program today. Caleb has, according to his bio, worked as a small-town newspaper reporter, an early morning janitor, and a whole animal butcher, among other things. But today we'll be talking about his debut novel, Treeborn, which is the story of the Treeborn family spanning three generations in a small Alabama town and the 70 acres of countryside land that they hold dear. Caleb, Treeborn begins with Janie Treeborn talking to a young man in what seems like a kind of like an oral history interview.
Yeah, there are a number of reasons of why. One, I'll just start with the most practical reason, is for the longest, she wasn't. She was just kind of running her mouth. It was a monologue. She was talking at the reader. And I got some feedback from some folks I trusted that as much as they love Janie, especially after they spent some time with her, they kind of felt assaulted in some way by her verbal acrobatics in this opening section. So what I decided to do was to insert this character that could kind of be a stand-in for the reader. And this way you can kind of sympathize with this character, because although interview is kind of a generous thing to be saying, because as you see in this opening chapter, she's really just talking at him about what she wants and how she wants and where she wants. So having this character in there, the reader can feel less assaulted by Janie and the way she talks and how much she talks, and sort of sympathize with this person. But also from a plot standpoint, you know, we know in the opening section that the fictional town of Alberta, Alabama is going to be washed away. It's going to be drowned, covered in water. So, you know, this person has come to gather some of the last stories remaining there before it's, if not vanished, certainly altered in a way that it hasn't been in some time.
Oftentimes when I'm reading for an interview, I'll go back when I finish a book and read the first chapter again and see what was laid out there by the author. And you do give us a lot of information in that first chapter if you're paying attention.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there that when I've been talking about the book, you know, I'll kind of clarify to say, you know, what I'm about to say is not a spoiler. It's all in the first page, or it's all in the first chapter. And there are just so many things that you know in those first few pages that will come back later in the book. There are a few different reasons why I did that. One is because the book, to me, a lot of it is about memory, and I certainly wanted the shape of the book and the structure to in some way mirror that or mimic the way memory works for me anyway. You know, Janie's an older woman. She's in this intense time in her life because she knows that no matter what she does, it's really futile. The land is going to change. She's going to have to leave or, you know, be drowned possibly. So her mind is running high and fast, and she's trying to recall things for this person. And sometimes when we do that, it all just comes out once in a rush or a bit of a flood. So that's one reason why it's happening so early in the book in this case.
There are two major timelines she's talking about in this interview, 1958, 1929. And the language in those sections are more florid than her speaking to her interlocutor. So are we actually seeing her memories, or what is the intermediary thing that's given us these stories?
It's what the reader wants it to be, is one way I would say. But it's an omniscient third-person narrator in those, but it's also a narrator that gets in really close inside the characters' heads and changes points of view. So it's something that maybe we're kind of taught or used to in literature we shouldn't really do or can't really work. So as I was writing it, I often thought of it as Janie as maybe a filter isn't the right word, but as sort of the source of where this narrator is getting this information. And I thought of the narrator as a person of this place and familiar with these stories and these people, which is one reason why the narrator can know so much and be so close and also have the bigger picture perspectives that the narrator has on the place and the people. But yeah, I mean, it's Janie's story. You know, she's the last keeper of all these stories. So at the time when the book opens, you know, everything in a way is kind of tumbling down from her.
Those timelines of 29 and 58 aren't presented to us linearly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of going back and recapitulation and starting earlier in the story. Is that the way it's coming out of her memory, or is it just in order to heighten the dramatic tension of the writing?
A little bit of both. I mean, it's certainly meant to kind of mimic how her memory would work. But, you know, I had a friend of mine early on when I was sort of struggling writing this book say, why don't you try starting as deep into the story as you can and then go back? And I kind of hadn't thought of trying that before. I'd tried a lot of things because sort of how my process works is I overwrite and I just know I'm going to write a bunch of garbage and stuff that'll be thrown away and that I'll never look at again. And I've just kind of made peace with that. And that's what I do. I plow forward, I overwrite, and then I try to save some things or go back and refine some things. So I did what he suggested, and I started a draft that started as deep into the story as I could. It kind of just gave me a freedom, I guess, to move around more like that into flashback and forward, and for narrative threads to kind of just drop and some come back and some don't. But until he told me that, even though so many books that I admire, particularly Southern books, do similar things, it had never occurred to me to try that in this book. And, you know, one book I can think of that's a huge influence for me is The Sharpshooter Blues by Lewis Norden, which does a similar thing, not exactly the same thing, but early on in the book, you know, we know a terrible thing has happened. We eventually know that some of these characters are dead, like pretty early on in the book. And we get this really beautiful meditation on a place, an introduction to a people, and we get a voice and the tone of the book. And that's really the first chunk. And then we go back, you know, about 50 pages in, maybe from my memory, we go back to before the crime happened, to before this inciting event happened. And once we get there, we go forward again from there. So, you know, I was influenced by books that did it that way, and I liked it as a reader. And for this book as a writer, it just seemed like the correct thing to do.
Can you see yourself writing about Alberta and the Treeborns again?
You know, I've been asked this too, and yes and no. So first off, and this doesn't spoil anything, because as you were saying, you get so much in the first few pages of the book. The story's bookended by the construction of a hydropower dam, and then it's demolition, which will flood the town, and the town's mostly abandoned when the book opens. So I've made it a little difficult on myself to be able to go back to this place in some ways, but there are spans of time. You know, a lot of the action takes place in 1958. Between then and the present day, we don't really know much about, you know, here and there we know snatches of what was happening to the Treborn family and in Alberta, but we don't know that much. So that's a place I could go back to. There are some characters who are not from Alberta or spent time outside of Alberta where, sure, I've thought about, and it may be interesting to follow their stories outside of this valley in town, but not right now. I'm gonna take a little distance from it and let it lay and kind of settle how it will.
I think there's several characters that could stand up and have more of their stories told, because, I mean, to set a crime fiction story with Big Connie, the local car dealer, and the lost shipment of dope that's coming in. Is it laudanum that they're taking?
Yeah, or morphine, or, you know, anything like that. Yeah, he's certainly one character. I mean, people have asked, how many main characters do you think there are in this book? And it's like, well, you know, how many do you want to argue? I think there are maybe more than half a dozen, you know. But Ricky Birdsong, I think, is, it's really his book in a lot of ways, even when he's not on the page or in the scene at a given time. He sort of looms over the town and a lot of the characters. He's a character, going back and looking at the book now, I wish I would have been able to write and fit more chapters in with him in scene and just with his story, because I think he was a fascinating character to write.
Seeing him go off to Mississippi to play college ball would have been a really good story to follow.
Yeah, it would. And just more of him, maybe with Lee Malone, who's sort of his only friend in town once his football career or dreams end. That'd be an interesting relationship, I think, to explore more. I mean, I think there's a lot of that, and I think one thing about the book, the way it's structured and the way narratives come and fit and starts and sort of drop out at times even, is that it does give me that opportunity to return to it if the notion strikes me.
In the book, after the initial framing, the first timeline we go to is 1958, and it's about Janie's Aunt Tammy, and Tammy has a passion for something. What is it?
Yeah, she loves movies. She loves this idea she has of Hollywood. I grew up in a very small town, and I love a lot of things about it, and I love a lot of things about small towns in the South that I visited, but they can be constricting places. They can stifle you, and that didn't stop people from having these hopes and dreams, and sometimes ill-advised or impossible just because of circumstances. So when I had this, the setting in the town, which was one of the first things I had in writing this book, I knew that was something I wanted to explore. I also love movies and have my whole life. You know, we had one video rental store in Arley, Alabama, where I grew up. It was mostly pretty big commercial movies they would get, but it seemed like they would always get one or two here and there of more independent cinema. And nobody ever rented those in Arley except me and maybe a couple other people. And I also quickly befriended the women who owned this video rental store over time. So they would sometimes let me have a copy early, you know, a couple days before the release date, or they would put movies back for me that they thought I would be interested in. And they did this when I was at a pretty young age because they saw my passion for movies and stories, I think. And also I had great parents who trusted that I could take in these stories and was mature enough to look at them in a way that wasn't going to necessarily change my reality. You know, like I could distinguish story and myth and fiction from real life at a young age. And so I have parents who let me watch kind of anything early on. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time in the video rental store, which I haven't thought about in a while. So there's probably some of that in Tammy. But, you know, I left my hometown. I eventually left Alabama to kind of go pursue a dream of mine, which was to study writing more closely and to write a novel and ultimately have it published. So I know that push and pull, and I know the way it feels to want to leave so bad and to hate a place and the way it makes you feel, but also not be able to leave it and want to come back to it and be drawn back to it, even if you know it's not the best thing for you or for what you want. It's a fascinating circumstance, and I think it's pretty particular to the South and small towns in the South in some way.
I'm just having an image of you going in there and saying, do you have the new Michael Haneke movie?
It wasn't quite that, but that later on it certainly was. But yeah, it was that kind of thing, you know.
Okay, Vim Vendors.
Yeah. It was two women, different women who owned the store, and one of them came to my reading in my hometown last night and actually signed her book to say, like, thank you for all the movies that you gave me, because I love movies, and it's certainly something my fiance and I joke and call it narrative research whenever we're watching movies, because we were both writers, and we do, while we're watching them, that's what we're doing. We're trying to break them down and see how this story is being told and what we can kind of steal and hopefully use in our own writing.
So when you're writing and reading now, I mean, can you ever switch that off, or is that always on?
It's pretty impossible. Yeah, it's pretty tough, which takes a little bit of the fun out of it. The fun for me, whether it's movies or books, is discussing them after you've seen them or read them with friends and different people. And so it makes it a little harder for me to do that, because most people are not watching or reading from a craft perspective, because most people are not writing books or making movies. So that makes it a little more difficult, because there's just this kind of dissonance or disconnect when a friend of mine I've read the same book, and, you know, I'm thinking about how the author sketched in these characters really quick and then, you know, subtly changed them over the course of the book. And maybe my friend is just thinking if the story was engaging, you know, or if it was entertaining, or if he or she wanted to keep turning the page. And those things are great and important too, but it's just not the first thing I'm reading or watching for.
When you go back and watch stuff from your youth, can that disconnect happen, or is it just immediately reassessing what you used to like and then seeing the mechanics of it?
There's definitely a difference I see in reading or watching movies from long ago, and it's been a really cool thing. And one example I can give you that is not even from that long ago, but I love the Coen brothers movies. And when A Serious Man came out, which I guess that was about a decade ago, I did not like it that much. It was not one of my favorite Coen brothers movies. I didn't really get it, I guess you would say. And I quickly forgot sort of everything about it. And recently it appeared on Netflix, and I was home one afternoon and watched it, and it was a totally different experience. I got the humor in a way that I did not get before. I got the dynamics of the relationships in that movie, because it's really a movie about family in a lot of ways, which is obviously an interest of mine. And it just clicked in a way that, you know, a decade ago I wasn't ready for. And so that's something I try to keep in mind. You know, even today, if I pick up a book and I'm not immediately into it, or it doesn't seem like it's my thing, give it my best go, and I'll almost always finish instead of putting a book down. And then afterward, just to try to remember that, like, well, maybe it's just not the right time for me to come to this book and really connect to it, but maybe later, you know.
Through the course of the book, there are several characters that suffer a frustrated artistic impulse. There's Tammy, who has designs on Hollywood. There's Lee Malone, who has talent as a singer and recorded one side, not even a full 78 on both sides. And then Hugh Treborn, who has his outsider art impulse. And I was just wondering, what is this idea of the frustrated artist that runs through this town?
Well, as you can imagine, Stephen, I wouldn't know anything about being a frustrated artist, having spent however many years writing a novel. But I have a lot of friends, and I'm lucky in this way, who are artists of different kinds. You know, over the years and coming of age with each other and seeing our art progress, and some people, you know, make it, quote unquote, and some stop, and some just keeping on lowering their heads and plugging along. we've just had a lot of conversations about it. And it's always something, I guess, we're trying to help each other figure it out. To be a little more specific, a lot of my friends are independent musicians. And in my earlier years, I used to spend a lot of time traveling around with them to their shows just because I had free time and I liked spending time with them. And so I would just get in the van and go with them on these jaunts around the South. And when you're in a van for 8 hours a day, and then you get to a bar or a rock club or whatever, and you're just waiting around for the show to start late at night, there's just a lot of time to kill, so you just talk. So we would talk about art, not only the art we were trying to make, but art we enjoyed, art we didn't enjoy, art made by people we knew and know. I always thought those conversations were pretty interesting, and I think a lot of them found their ways, at least maybe the big ideas about what we were trying to get after in our naive ways, kind of found it into these conversations with characters, whether it was Lee Malone or Hugh Treborn or Tammy Treborn.
And also there's another theme of these extreme physical injuries. Janie loses an eye early on. Lee Malone loses hearing in one ear. Ricky Birdsong has a cerebral event that changes his life. Wooten Ragsdale, Tammy's husband, loses almost all the fingers on one of his hands. But then we see later that this isn't the worst that's going to happen to them, that psychological and emotional pain can be so much worse than this physical pain.
Yeah, I mean, that's a beautiful way to put it. That's something I saw growing up in a small rural community. There were a lot of people, whether it was farming or factory accidents or military veterans, who would have some sort of physical injury or handicap in some way. And it was unremarkable, or at least they didn't remark upon it. But I kind of always just got this sense, and especially the older I got, that inside, like you said, sort of emotionally and mentally, it was much worse than it looked on the outside. And they very much, you know, did the noble thing of, I mean, they had no choice. I guess there's really no nobility in it. They had to keep working. You know, they had families. They had sort of no other options to a degree in a small country place. So if they could keep doing what they did to survive, they, despite their physical limitations, they did it. So that's something that I always found kind of fascinating, especially the older I got and sort of got to know some of these folks as an adult. I began to think more about what it was like on the inside for them, not just the way it looked on the outside.
Now, with the mention of Wooten Ragsdale, who's married to Tammy, in this 1958 storyline, Wooten is concerned. He can't find Tammy.
She goes missing, and he is concerned eventually. But at first, he's maybe not as concerned as some people would think they would be if their wife was missing or not coming home. But once you get to know Tammy a little bit, you may realize why he maybe was a little bit relieved at first until the worry hits him. When we get to the 1958 timeline, she has gone missing. Wooten, he's kind of looking for her, and he pretty quickly decides, well, what she'd been saying for years she wanted to do and was going to do, she was going to go to Hollywood. She was going to become an actress. That was her destiny and dream, she believed, as maybe foolish as it may seem to some other people in town. And so that's what he decides she's done. And even though he decides it, I guess he, maybe part of him knows that she's never really going to go to Hollywood. So he sort of plays along with this search for her too that the town organizes.
There's something in the family. It's called the Seven. What's the Seven?
Yeah, so the Seven is what the Treborn family calls the land that they own and have lived on for generations. It's 700 acres of wooded land, hills and hollers, sandstone bluffs, you know, deep woods, creeks and streams. And it's important to them in a way that I would say borders on religious, you know, in a less traditional sense. You know, when you grow up in a small rural place, the land really is, if you own any, it's the most important thing you have for a number of, I'm not talking in a financial sense even, although sometimes that can be the case, but it does connect you to those ancestors and previous generations, and it does make you feel as if you have a purpose for being here, because it's not always easy to be in a place like Alberta, the fictional Alberta in the book, or like in Arley where I grew up. You know, those aren't easy places to live, and we don't choose where we're born to. Some of us are privileged enough and lucky enough to get out and try other places, but having this land and having this connection with it and feeling like it matters, and it matters to keep it in the family and to keep it doing what its job is to do, I guess, which is to give you a reason for why you're here, is something I grew up experiencing. And the Seven is, a lot of people have asked me, since this is my first novel, I think, how autobiographical it is. And I'll say that the Seven is really the closest thing to a one-to-one representation of something in reality or in my life and to something in the book. And it's pretty much just a larger more mythic version of the land my grandmama still owns and lives on in Arley, Alabama.
700 acres is just a little bit over a mile square. And this isn't like bottom land where you could develop it for farming or for residential living. It would be tough to exploit it financially anyway.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, your best shot would be, which is what Wooten and Tammy decide to do in the book, is to cut down the timber and sell what you can to make money off that. You know, yeah, you're not going to develop it. There aren't other natural resources that can be extracted from it. And that's much what it's like in Arley, Alabama, and Winston County, where I'm from. It's hills and hollers. It's, you know, what farmland there is to be had has never been bigger commercial farming. It's been more subsistence farming that folks have used just to get by on. But it's all about scale in a way too, I guess, because sure, it's not going to change Tammy and Wooten's life to cut down those trees and make a little money off of it. You know, if they had children, it wouldn't make their lives radically different, but it would in some way, you know, help and change the pressures of their lives and existence in this place. And that's something I've seen play out a lot at home too.
But it is something that Janie, when she's young, she's the one telling the story at the beginning of the book, she hates their attempt to develop the land.
Yeah, she does. I mean, she maybe loves the land more than anybody, than except maybe her grandmama, Maybelle Treborn. And one reason why is because of, you know, like I was saying a moment ago, who it connects her to. It connects her to her past. It connects her to her grandparents, one of which she never really knew, and the other of which she knew and loved so much and then was taken away from her. So Janie has this idea in her mind that if she can just stay on this land and spend as much time on it as possible, and it stays the same, and she does the same things that she did on it with Maybelle, then she can keep Maybelle alive in some way that otherwise she'll have a hard time doing.
Tammy inherited the land from her mother, Maybelle, but there are two brothers. There's Janie's father, Wren, and Luther, and it didn't seem that it was quite legit how everything went down.
Yeah, Tammy sort of manipulates her mother in one way or another. Or not sort of, she manipulates her mother. She gets the will changed to where she's the sole beneficiary of the land, and her brothers get a little bit of something. But, you know, she promises them that, like, she'll share it, of course. She'll split it up. It'll still be the family's land. In that respect, Tammy's sort of the villain, and it's one of the first times we see, you know, in the 80, 90 years we see of the Treborns in this book, a lot of the threat to them and their way of life comes from the outside. But in this case, the threat is coming from within the family, and it really kind of throws them into disarray.
Now, while we get to know a little bit more about Wren and his wife in the course of the story, we don't learn much about Luther. And I was wondering, what's up with Luther?
He's a bit of a comic character, I guess, a little tragic too, but he is just spending a lot of his time in this timeline that we're looking at in the book in a bit of a drug haze. He's easygoing by nature. He's a veteran, so he's left Alberta and seen some things. And when he comes back to kind of cope and deal with what he's got going on, he's self-medicating. He's a more minor character, especially in the Treborn family. Yeah, I don't know about Luther.
Just curious. One of those many people that
yeah.
Him and Buckshot, those yeah. are the kind of the two cursory characters that kind of intrigue me.
Yeah, well, Buckshot, I think he's almost more of a major character than Luther in a
yeah,
lot of
he
ways.
Is, yeah.
You know, I love dogs so much, and I grew up around them. And when you grow up in the country, dogs seem to kind of have lives of their own in a way that in the city they don't, because they're mostly just outside by themselves, and most yards are not fenced in, and they just kind of wander around, and they'll form packs or not. You know, they may be gone for days sometimes, and then they'll just show back up. And I've always kind of been fascinated with where they're going and what they're doing, you know, and that independence. And so I wanted to have a dog in this book that, although Buckshot is really loyal to Lee Malone and they have a really strong bond, he also spends some time wandering, you know, and he also spends some time with some of the other characters that Lee doesn't necessarily know about. And I just found that a fascinating thing for a dog to have that kind of autonomy and independence in a narrative.
Janie talks about Lee Malone at the top of the book, and he owns the big peach orchard in the 1958 storyline. And it's really unusual time for an African-American man to have that much land and not suffer from like constant attacks from the white community.
Yeah, he kind of had the blessing for a while of Mr. Prince, who owned the orchards and the peach cannon facility, and is sort of this unknowable and admired from afar wealthy man in the mythology of Alberta. So Mr. Prince sold, for lack of a better word, all he kind of just gave the place to Lee Malone. So there was some amount of protection just with Mr. Prince's bestowing the place to Lee in a way. But by the time we pick up in the 50s, Lee's had it for a little while, and a little bit of that goodwill from Mr. Prince, since he's passed away and is gone, is starting to fade away.
And Lee's background is a very unusual background to have.
Yeah, so he was raised by white parents after his mama died, and his dad was a traveling musician who he never really knew. He grew up learning to play music and sing in a white hillbilly church, and though he lives in Freedom Hills, which is the black neighborhood in Alberta, I guess at this time, really the only character who crosses over and spends time in these two different Albertas which exist.
Let's not neglect the 1929 storyline.
Okay.
Jane and his grandparents, Hugh and Maybelle. Hugh is working on the DeSoto Dam, which is the thing that gives him a financial living. It's probably rural electrification is coming from it. But as we see 80 years later, it's going to be the ruination of the land below it.
I don't know how much Hugh realizes of that at the time, you know, in 1929, 1930, but he certainly has an idea that things are going to change and that he's a part of it now that he has taken a job with the authority. And that's a conflict for him that causes a lot of emotional and mental turmoil and a fair amount of guilt. So he, I don't want to spoil some of the things he does, but he certainly reacts to that. It certainly also alters, I think, the way he makes art and the kind of art he winds up making.
Now, he refers to his art as assemblies. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what these are and why does he call it an assembly?
Yeah, so assemblies are, if you could imagine a frame without canvas on it, assemblies are just everything that Hugh Treborn collects in the woods or wherever he may be walking and decides to in some way nail, screw, glue, burn, tape onto these frames. So they're three-dimensional. They are made with natural objects, you know, dirt and plants or animal bones, but also pieces of tin he finds or other various trash that he finds. When I was a kid, I would spend a lot of time in the woods, and I would walk around, and I would come upon things because when storms blow through and rain falls and wind, stuff gets scattered. It's in the woods. It gets covered up. Sometimes it gets revealed. And I'd come across these things and be by myself and also be pretty young and just not be able to imagine how they could have got there. And it would be simple things, you know, maybe a plastic jug that some antifreeze had been in or something like that. But it was way out in the woods. And I would just in my head start to make up stories for how that object got there. By the time I got back to the house where my mama and grandmama and great aunts were, they would ask me what I'd been doing all day, and I would kind of relay these stories to them. That's kind of the first time I sort of became a storyteller, I feel like, where it was in those woods and seeing these things and coming back and being encouraged to tell these stories. So in some way, although I didn't actually bring the objects back and put them together, I feel like I kind of did like Hugh and assembled stories out of these things I saw in the woods. But they're called assemblies because he literally assembles them from things he found. I've been asked about inspirations for that and for Hugh Treborn's art. And there's a artist from Bessemer, Alabama, which is a still town outside Birmingham, and named Thornton Dial. And I mean, he makes works of all sizes, but a lot of his stuff is very alive, although he's using these found objects. They suggest movement and life in a way that really struck me. They're often interesting textures and not flat works of art, you know, three-dimensional in a way that just fascinated me. Thornton Dial's work was what I was thinking of a lot when I wrote Hugh Treborn and his assemblies.
You know, nowadays it'd be considered outside art because it didn't fall into enough kind of conventions to be folk art. You know, this was completely his thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a fair term because he is certainly living outside society, even in this odd sort of off the radar place. He's very much an outsider, although he's from there and of the place and has been for generations, which I think is an interesting dynamic too.
A man named Loudermilk from back east wanders through town and changes his idea on what he's doing.
He does. It's funny. I had someone say to me, of course you had to make the Yankee the villain. And
well, he's from Baltimore. That's not quite a Yankee.
Well,
I guess to Alabama.
When you're from
is.
Alabama, yeah. That, we're going to say that's a Yankee. Yeah, so Loudermilk comes to town, and he's a man who has been traveling around the South discovering these artists. And he comes across a piece of Hugh Treborn's and shows up on the 7 and makes a pitch to take his art and make him some money, put on a show, an exhibition of his art. Hugh is skeptical and he's also a little disinterested, but something tells him, why not, you know? And he goes without trusting much and lets Loudermilk leave the Seven with a trunk full of assemblies that he can fit in there.
I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you know, but the Leuven brothers' real name is Loudermilk.
I'm very much aware of that, okay. and a big fan of their music. Yeah.
And I was just wondering, since they had taken what was from the country and took it to town.
And they're from North Alabama. Yeah. So.
And they lived in Memphis for quite a time, worked at the post office here. And
yeah, exactly. No, I won't say that I named him after them necessarily, but it was very much on my mind.
North Alabama has given a lot to Memphis over the years. W.C. Handy is from North Alabama, and of course, the Leuvens. Fame Studios up in Muscle Shoals, and that whole scene has given a lot to the Memphis sound over the years as well.
Yeah, it has. It's an interesting trade. And then I of course, feel an extreme connection and affinity to Memphis because I'm such a fan of Stax Records, and I'm such a fan of Elvis, thanks to my grandmama. I also, being someone from a working class background, have a lot of interest in the civil rights movement here with the sanitation workers strike. And it's a place that I've always, although I haven't spent a lot of time here, I feel like there's this sort of like spiritual or artistic highway connecting North Alabama and Memphis, at least for me and my people.
Now, there's another character who's very enigmatic and has to be discussed in at least some broad terms, and that's Crusoe.
Mm-hmm. This has been the toughest thing for me to figure out how to talk about, because there's not a lot that can be spoiled in the book necessarily because of how it's structured, but Crusoe is something I like to leave on the page for a surprise for the reader, because I think it is fairly surprising when he comes on a scene. But let's see how I can say this. Crusoe is a character that has been with the Treeborns through multiple generations. He is sort of a mixture between a creation of Hugh Treeborns, I would say, in some way, and also this sort of spiritual embodiment of the land and what the Treeborns carry around with them. I have a funny story kind of about him that just shows, you know, we were talking earlier about how things sort of just emerge in the subconscious. I read from an early manuscript of this in graduate school, and I read a Crusoe section, and I had a teacher come up to me afterward and she said, oh, he's a golem.
I was wondering what paper would be put in his mouth to animate him.
Exactly. And I said, excuse me? And she said, he's a golem. And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about, because growing up in rural North Alabama, there are not Jewish people there these days. And, you know, I went to college in Tuscaloosa and had a couple Jewish friends, but I just didn't know much about Jewish culture or folklore. She told me this, my professor, and I kind of did some research and looked it up, and I realized, whoa, he kind of is, you know. And Hugh Treeborn kind of has this air of a heretical, you know, spiritual leader of some kind out in the woods, communing with the land and his art. So it kind of made sense. It wasn't something that then I was very aware of and trying to make that mythology and those stories fit with Crusoe. But it's cool that would emerge. And I think it just goes to show that it's a compelling story, because how long has a version of it been being told, and how far across the globe and through different cultures and places. And then it winds up being fascinating too, because now I'm fixing to marry a Jewish woman, and I've spent a lot more time with her family and learning a little bit about their culture and past. So it's just wild that I would have this sort of connection in some way to that story in my book about rural Alabama.
It just points out, I mean, there are things that just are part of human thoughts.
Yeah.
Goes throughout cultures. And
certainly.
Did you have scholastic book fairs when you were a kid? Did they still have them then?
Mm-hmm.
I was fascinated with monster movies when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
And I'd bought a book about monster movies at one of the scholastic book fairs. And The Golem was one of the movies they talked about in there. So when I was a kid, I was fascinated with golems early on.
Nice. Yeah. Crusoe's not a monster, but there's certainly a little bit of that. I think there's a little bit of horror, and some folks I've talked to who have read the book so far have expressed they were a little horrified or frightened when he walks or does things. It's really just a matter of how Crusoe came to be. He sort of just emerged for me on the page like he does in this version of the book, which is he just appeared in scene. And for the longest, as I was writing these pages, I felt as if there was something magic, I guess, for lack of a better word, or something unknown on the margins in these woods, in the Seven. And I just didn't know what it was going to be. And then it wound up being Crusoe. And then after I saw him, it was revealed to me through writing and thinking about the characters, his creation story. It wasn't something I came up with his creation first and then set him in motion. He just kind of appeared, and then I worked backward to figure out how he got there and why. And it was natural to me in a way, because the women who raised me are oral storytellers, and their specialty is ghost stories and the supernatural. And, you know, I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church, which I'm not affiliated with anymore, but Christianity is some spooky stuff in it, you know, and there's supernatural things in it and unexplained things. And I like that, and I'm okay with it, even as an adult who, you know, has gone on and got some degrees and lived around and has different ideas about what religion means to me or what spirituality or supernatural things mean. But I'll always sort of have an easy time, I guess, believing in unexplained things or ghosts or a bit of magic, especially when it's related to the natural world, because there is just so much about it we don't know and never really will or really will be able to fully explain.
Now, where you're from is pretty much kind of like the bottom end of the Appalachians. Mm-hmm. And I come from the edge of the Ozarks over in northwest Arkansas. And a lot of people that populated the Ozarks came from Appalachia. And there's one thing that I've never seen in a work of fiction before that's very much, and it's not even widespread in the Ozarks, but it's an Ozark thing, chocolate gravy.
Chocolate gravy, really?
Yes.
So you're saying you had chocolate gravy or never did?
No, I grew up with chocolate gravy.
Okay. I did too. Yeah, and I had to get it in there. Yeah, my mama makes just amazing chocolate gravy, and I love to cook. I'm fascinated by food and thinking about it and writing about it. But I've tried to make chocolate gravy with her standing there and using her recipe, and it's just kind of such a fickle thing, because if it boils too much, it's not going to come out the right consistency, or if it doesn't boil enough, or it's too much flour, you know, like people try to ask me what it is, and they say, is it like chocolate syrup? And I say, well, kind of, but not really. And then they're shocked when they say, well, what do you do with it? And I say, well, you put it on biscuits, just like biscuits and gravy, it's biscuits and chocolate gravy. So I've learned how, and I'm very proud of my trial and error to make good buttermilk biscuits. But when I come home, I'll make the biscuits and I'll still leave it up to mama to do the chocolate gravy.
Now, do you do your biscuits in half or do you tear them up in little chunks?
I just open mine up in half and then I just drown them in the chocolate gravy and then cut them one piece at a time.
See, I think when you tear them in chunks, you get more surface area. You get more gravy that way.
Maybe so. Maybe I need to try that.
What you're describing kind of sounds like more in southern part of Arkansas near Ashdown. I went to a breakfast buffet and they actually had chocolate gravy on there, and it was thinner and darker. My grandmother's is more almost like a thin custard, had more of a milky and a little bit less of a bitter flavor to it than the other ones I've had.
Yeah, this is thinner. It's a little runnier and definitely darker too. And of course you have to put, you know, there's butter in it, and there's butter in the biscuits,
yep.
But you got to put a pat of butter. And then you let that hot gravy hit the butter and it melts and runs off the edges. It's just like, it's the most beautiful sight to me.
Well, with the thicker one that we have, you put the butter on top and you watch the butter melt on top across all the gravy.
Yeah. So it's on, it's a different kind of beauty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get to watch that melting going on and you just know, get a little bit of that butter on there and.
Nice.
Oh, it's a delightful thing. I have.
You're reminding me now, I was home only for a couple days this week and it didn't even occur to me to try to get any chocolate gravy, but I'll be back in about a week. And so now I'm going to make a note to myself to just tell mama, make sure she's got the stuff to make it.
I have an aunt that I visit and she will make some for me whenever I visit.
Nice.
One of the things that I thought was really true to life, but is confusing just a touch, is that in towns, even a big town like Birmingham or Memphis or something like that, there'll be so many businesses that are named after kind of the local feature. And in that area, it's the peach. So many things are called the peach pit in there, that it kind of gets a little bit overwhelming for the reader that's not used to everything like that.
The peach, I knew it was for a time in Alberta, the driving economic force. And I knew I wanted to also drive the mythology of the place. And the story behind that is, where I grew up in North Alabama, when you go to the beach for summer vacation, if you get to go, you drive straight through Chilton County, which is our peach growing region. It's the best peaches. They're really ripe and delicious and soft. And you always stop at a fruit stand and buy a basket and take it and you eat them for the first couple of days, because if you don't eat them right away, they're going to go bad while you're at the beach. And so that's something I grew up every year doing. And to me, the peach was I just assumed it was native to Alabama and to the South. I mean, it seemed as Alabama as college football to me. And then I was doing some reading, and I discovered that some historians think that Hernando de Soto brought the peach to what became the southeastern United States by way of China and the Silk Road on his conquest of this area. And I was just stunned. I thought that was fascinating on one level because you have this delicate, beautiful fruit making its way all the way across continents and oceans like that, to only to be in what was a really wild and pretty completely unexplored place, you know, outside of the native folks who lived here, but certainly by Europeans at the time. And it winds up coming on this bloody conquest and finding purchase in the ground and being grown over generations. And here I am in, you know, the 1900s eating it on my way to the beach. And I was fascinated by that. So what I thought when I first started writing this novel is I thought, well, I'm going to write a pretty straight historical novel about De Soto's conquest of the South. I didn't think there was a novel about that. I found the story with the peach interesting, and I also found it appealing that with that, I'd have a beginning, middle, and end, because although De Soto's time here and path is pretty disputed, it's pretty agreed upon he landed in Western Florida, pretty agreed upon generally he wandered all, you know, Georgia up into eventually the Carolinas, over Alabama, a little into Tennessee, Mississippi, up to Arkansas, to the river, and people think his body was probably placed in the river or at least buried nearby the river. So I had a beginning, middle, and end. So for someone who was trying to write a novel and publish it for the first time, that seemed appealing to me, that I had a little bit of a backbone for a story. And so I actually started doing this, and I pretty quickly realized I do not enjoy the kind of research I need to do to write a novel set in the 1500s. The joy for me is in composing early drafts and discovering the characters and the place. And I found myself having to stop all the time to go search what something would have looked like or what they would have had with them on this conquest or just things like that. So I was being slowed down by the research in a way that I just was not having fun. So I decided I'm not going to do this. And when I decided that, I had to figure out something else to do. And I eventually did, but I couldn't let go of De Soto and that mythology and that story and the idea of the peach coming here through this violent expedition and, you know, lasting through these generations. And so I said, I'm just going to make that the fascination and mythology of this fictional town I've created, since it's mine in life too.
And it's appropriate that the man, Big Connie, who owns the car lot and is kind of the macher in town, dresses up as De Soto.
Yeah, he wears his De Soto outfit for sales at the used car lot and for other big events in town, like the Peach Days Parade. We all know, if we've, you know, in cities and small towns in the South, we all know these used car salesmen and these salesmen of different kinds who come up with sort of gimmicks like this based on a local celebrity or important historical moment or whatever. Sometimes it's in poor taste. In this case, it kind of is, because De Soto was such a terrible person for the landscape and the people who were living here. But yeah, Big Connie does that, and he sort of wants to pass this tradition down and his business down to his son, Pud, who's not quite the type of son that Big Connie wishes he would be, and he's trying to do the classic Southern parent thing of forcefully molding him into that person he wants him to be.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised you used the name Pud for him. When I was young, that was quite the wrong word to say.
It can be. Actually, I know a couple people from Louisiana with that name, like from Western Louisiana. So I just thought it was a good name. A lot of the names in this book, you know, if you've read it, you can tell that language was important to me and rhythm was important to me. So a lot of times with the names of places or people, one of the first things I was thinking of was, how would it sound spoken aloud, you know, and how would it sound in the places in the book where it would often appear.
Are you working on anything right now?
I am. I'm working on another novel. I'm not going to say much about it other than that it's set in another fictional Alabama town and pretty much entirely in the present day, or at least as close to the present day as you can get with a novel because of how long it takes to sell and edit and finally get on shelves. So yeah, I'm working on that. I'm working on some shorter nonfiction pieces because those are just nice to sort of break up a novel and the work it requires. And also, if you get stuck or a little bored, instead of just putting the novel away or making yourself miserable, you can go and piddle with these shorter nonfiction pieces. So that's something I'm doing too.
Well, Caleb, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your book with us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Caleb Johnson is the author of Treeborn, which is published by Picador. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.